I'm Julie Burstein. I'm here for Leonard Lopate. It's hard to believe that this month marks the 40th anniversary of the trial of the Watergate 7. Patricia T. O'Connor, our resident word maven, has done her own investigation into a variety of words and phrases that were introduced as a result, and she's come by today to share them with us. You can call us as well with any input you have on the topic. Our number is 646-433-9692. I'm sorry, it's 212-433-9692. Pat, can you remind us again who were on trial?
Yes, well, the Watergate 7 were primarily G. Gordon Liddy and E. Howard Hunt. They were the main folks.
And before G. Gordon Liddy was a talk show host,
yes,
and all of that. Yes,
and there were five others. And they went on trial in January of 1973, 40 years ago this month. And Liddy and Hunt were the only two of the seven who did not plead guilty. So they actually were tried to the end and convicted. And in the following month, it was only a month-long trial, under Judge John Sirica. And on the following month, the Senate voted to conduct hearings, nationally televised hearings, into the Watergate scandal, which was enormously entertaining for those of us who were around in those days. And at the time, I was a graduate student in journalism, and it was heaven. It was a journalism student's dream come true. Those days bring back a lot of nostalgia for me. You're probably too young to remember
Watergate. No, I was just thinking, I was a kid, but I remember my father in our den saying, "Julie, come in here. This is history. You got to see this." So the fact that this was on television, he was completely right.
There was such drama every day, and at night, Walter Cronkite would sum up the day's events on the news. It was just so exciting. Every day, there was some new revelation. But the trial and the hearings not only shook the White House to its foundations, but it also changed our political vocabulary. And I got the idea for this topic because a friend of mine, the author Hugh Rosson, has been writing about this on the Cambridge Dictionaries online. He's been doing articles this month, and he will do more next month. But those of us who lived through Watergate will never forget the language that was popularized by the scandal, words like dirty tricks, deep throat, inoperative, smoking gun,
which
follow
like,
the money.
Of course, but these were new.
Well,
they weren't exactly new.
They weren't exactly new, but they were popularized. So they really sprang to the forward consciousness. Some things were absolutely new, but some were new uses of old words. For example, do you remember the plumbers?
Oh, yes.
Yes, well, the Watergate burglars were called the plumbers because one of their missions was to plug leaks of government information. And as for the break-in itself, the president's press secretary, Ron Ziegler, memorably characterized it as a third-rate burglary attempt. President Nixon himself referred to it as hanky-panky, and H.R. Haldeman, his chief of staff, called it the Watergate caper. So all of these words were being kicked around.
As a way of trying to kind of say, oh, it's not such a big deal.
This exactly.
It's just hanky-panky.
There was a lot of euphemism going on. And some of these things we didn't know until after the presidential tapes were released. But we learned that Nixon, in March of 73, told his aides to stonewall, that is, obstruct any attempt to link the White House with the burglary. He told his aides, "I want you all to stonewall it. Let them plead the Fifth Amendment, cover up, or anything else. If it'll save it, save the whole plan."
And Stonewall is interesting, especially at that moment in time. Was this before or after the Stonewall riots?
This was just after. This was about 4 years after the Stonewall riots.
And there's also Stonewall Jackson. So Stonewall.
Right. Rawson's opinion is that this sense of Stonewall is more connected with Stonewall Jackson because he was famous for being very stubbornly defensive and for holding out, especially, for instance, the second battle of Bull Run. He held out for a long time, and so he was the image of the stone wall that doesn't give way. So the verb stonewall, I think, came from, probably was influenced at least by that.
Do you remember, Pat, when you were watching these as a journalism student, were you listening in this way, or did this passion for this language for you come a bit later?
Well, I realized at the time that language was being used in a rather euphemistic way. And at the time I was watching the hearings, of course, the tapes hadn't been released. So some of this stuff hadn't come out.
Right.
But during the hearings, there were, and during the press conferences during early 1973, there was a lot of language that was very circumlocutious. And for journalism students who are always taught to make things ultra clear and to avoid uselessly big words or obfuscatory words, of course, this was a picnic.
Yeah.
I mean, they were doing it like crazy. For one of the most famous examples is that in April of 73, the president announced that real progress had been made in finding the truth about the Watergate break-in. Now, interestingly, earlier, the White House had denied any involvement. So when pressed by reporters to reconcile this announcement with the earlier denials, Ron Ziegler, the press secretary, simply kept repeating, "This is the operative statement. This is the operative statement."
He sounds like a computer.
That's yes.
So
Johnny Apple of the New York Times asked if that meant the previous statements were now inoperative. And so Ziegler leaps in. I mean, it wasn't very smart of him, but he leaped in and said, "Yes, the others are now inoperative." So think how that made the president's credibility look. Everything we've been saying up to now is inoperative. Of course, any fool can tell that that means it was a lie. Previous statements were lies.
So now I can say to my kids, "Is that inoperative, like you just said?"
Yeah, that statement
not
was
that
inoperative.
My kids lie,
right.
Really
I didn't
don't.
Break your iPad. That was, yeah.
You know, what's interesting, Pat, is that this era was so beautifully dramatized in All the President's Men.
Yes, yes. The book by Carl Bernstein and Bob Woodward about their, they were the Washington Post reporters who did really the hottest reporting on this. They wrote a book called All the President's Men, and it became a movie that with a script by William Goldman. And in one of the scenes, Deep Throat, the mysterious source who fed leaks to Woodward and Bernstein, I think it was played by Hal Holbrook
yes.
in the movie. Anyway, he tells the reporters, "Follow the money."
Should we listen to that?
Yes.
"You tell me what you know, and I'll confirm. I'll keep you in the right direction if I can, but that's all. Just follow the money."
And was that a new phrase, Pat? Is that something that...
Well, I don't know if that was the first use of it. But interestingly, that wasn't in the book, and it wasn't in any of the news reporting. And when William Goldman was asked where he came up with it, he said, "Well, gee, I couldn't have made it up. I must have heard it somewhere."
Mm.
It's not in any of Woodward's notes or anything.
It's such a great phrase.
Yes.
And it sort of boils the whole thing down.
Yes. And, you know, Deep Throat was probably the most famous whistleblower of all time. We now know that he was the associate FBI director, Mark Felt. I think there may be another clip.
Let's,
Deep Throat
let's
in
listen.
It?
"The money's the key to whatever this is."
"Says who?"
"Deep Throat."
"Who?"
"Oh, that's Woodward's garage freak, his source in the executive."
"Garage freak? Jesus, what kind of a crazy f-ing story is this?
Who did you say?"
"He's on deep background. I call him Deep Throat."
So yeah. Deep Throat, you know, there was that movie. Was
that
at the same time?
Yeah, it was just before this. That was a play on the title of the porn movie, Deep Throat. But interestingly, two of Nixon's aides, H.R. Haldeman and John Ehrlichman, were responsible for a lot of the colorful and melodramatic language that was familiar to us now because of Watergate. I mean, things that we may have heard before, but they attained a special significance. For example, the term deep six. Ehrlichman suggested to John Dean, the president's counsel, that he deep six the phone tapping equipment that had been found in E. Howard Hunt's office safe. Hunt was one of the plumbers. Dean later told the Senate Watergate Committee that he didn't understand what deep six meant. Dean didn't. So he asked Ehrlichman, "What do you mean?" And Ehrlichman said, he explained to him that what he meant by deep six was he was supposed to toss the briefcase into the Potomac when he drove across the river to get home at night. So he's supposed to toss this briefcase full of wiretapping equipment into the river. Actually, deep six is an old term. It's a seafaring term, meaning to throw something overboard into water at least 6 fathoms deep. That's 36.
Which would lose feet. It forever,
yeah,
one would
pretty
think.
Much. Yeah. Pretty much. Then another Ehrlichmanism is really creepy. Let him twist slowly, slowly in the wind.
Yes, one of our listeners wrote into that,
yes.
About that one.
Yes, Ehrlichman said this in reference to L. Patrick Gray, who'd been nominated to replace J. Edgar Hoover as head of the FBI. He was the White House's candidate. Well, during his nomination hearings, or his confirmation hearings, L. Patrick Gray let it slip that John Dean, the president's lawyer, was privy to the FBI's Watergate investigations and was sitting in on a lot of meetings. And, of course, this, you know, was a little embarrassing for the White House. So it more or less turned its back on Gray.
And let him twist.
And let him twist in the wind. Now, Haldeman had been an advertising executive, and some of his comments that we later were privy to have the tang of Madison Avenue. For instance, at one point he told Dean, "We have to keep the cap on the bottle." And at another time he told him, "Just remember that once the toothpaste is out of the tube, it's going to be very tough to get it back in."
Were these all things that were within the slang of the day, do you think? Or did
yeah,
they become, because right now...
I think they were in the slang of the day, mm-hmm. but they really came to the forefront when they became part of this incredible scandal, one of the greatest scandals, political scandals ever.
That was televised.
Oh, yes. It all happened on TV. And Dean came up with a lot of good things, too. He told President Nixon in March of 73 that the conspiracy was unraveling and it was threatening to become a cancer on the presidency.
And this is the president who, did he declare a war on cancer? Was it Nixon or was somebody? Oh, I don't know.
I don't know.
But somebody declared a war. That's so interesting.
Yeah, and a lot of, during the Senate Watergate hearings, Dean frequently used the phrases at this point in time and at that point in time instead of now and then. Further, just using unnecessary bureaucratic language, which, of course, doesn't fool anybody.
Mavis from Dobbs Ferry asked how and why people started saying something similar, as best as I can remember. Is that something that was that part of this?
To the best of my recollection,
yes.
Or often what they said was, "I can't recall." There's a spot on one of the tapes that was released later that Nixon was forced by a Supreme Court ruling to release the tapes. He fought that to the very end. He's heard saying on one of the tapes that if anyone is in a situation where he doesn't want to perjure himself, all he has to do is say, "I can't recall." So we heard a lot of that during the hearings.
I am speaking with Patricia T. O'Connor. She's here and talking about the complexities of the English language. And we're taking your questions. You can call us at 212-433-9692. Leave a comment on our show page or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We will have more about Watergate after a break.
Oh, baby, what I'd give to hear those three little words. Man, that's such a wonderful phrase.
Three little words, oh, what I'd give for that.
I'm Julie Burstein. I'm here for Leonard Lopate, and I'm here with Patricia T. O'Connor. And we are remembering a January 40 years ago when Watergate became the subject of everybody's conversations and where new phrases came up. Patricia, there are other things that came through, like, was this where there was smoking gun? Was that something that became...
Oh, yeah. Smoking gun was a good one. This was a phrase used by Congressman Barbara Conable. If you... remember, you probably don't if you were a kid, but Nixon was forced to turn over the tapes by a unanimous Supreme Court decision. And when those tapes were turned over, Barbara Conable said that a couple of the conversations on the tape were the smoking gun that would prove the president lied to the nation, because those tapes showed that he knew about the burglary within a few days of it and was involved in the cover-up. So he said, these tapes are the smoking gun. So that became it probably existed before, but it was really made famous by that episode in history. Now, a lot of the language of Watergate is drawn from the intelligence community. In other words, spying. Mm-hmm. For example, the famous phrase, dirty tricks. The use of this phrase to describe covert intelligence operations originated in the United States. The CIA's planning division was nicknamed the Department of Dirty Tricks in the 1960s. So that phrase was already around among spooks, spies. And later the term was applied to any underhanded political activity designed to discredit an opponent. So naturally, it glommed onto the Nixon administration's various attempts to smear its enemies.
Well, I know we told our listeners that we will take questions, and we have a few people. If you have a question, you can still give us a call at 212-433-9692. And let's go. These may not be Watergate questions, but I'm sure they'll be good ones. Let's go to Cheryl in Brooklyn. Cheryl, you have a question for Patricia T. O'Connor.
Yes, good afternoon, ladies.
Hello.
And thank you for answering my call. I want to say to Ms. O'Connor that I do so enjoy your segments. And I had an observation, and I really would like your opinion about it. It seems to me, being of the age where when I was in school they taught grammar, that the mighty adverb is falling, okay? And even in speaking and writing, we are substituting adjectives, and it makes me crazy when somebody says go slow instead of go slowly. I wondered, I know that you always say that language evolves, but why is that happening? And in the books that I read, I even see that happening. The other day, a commentator did the same thing on TV. It doesn't seem that to me that they have the command of grammar that used to be. And is the adverb slowly being left out of our speech?
Thank you, Cheryl.
I get this question a lot. And I'm old enough that I studied grammar in school, too. And I probably got the impression somewhere along the way that all adverbs have to end in L-Y. But in fact, many adverbs have two forms, with and without the L-Y. And slow and slowly are examples. So are quick and quickly, deep and deeply. They can be used as adverbs in either form.
That's great to know. As a writer, you want to be able to
have
a different impact with them.
Yes,
slow
yes.
and slowly are very yes. feel very different.
Yes. Now, I should say that often the tailless adverb, say slow or deep, comes after the verb. For instance, it's perfectly grammatically correct to say drive slow, or run quick, or think fast. Well, of course, fast is both too. But
think fastly would be a little odd.
Right. Yeah. Plunge deep into this subject. But if you put the adverb before, you'd probably use the L-Y version, slowly drive. You wouldn't say slow drive.
And if you said a deep dive, you would make it a noun rather than a verb.
Then it would be an adjective, the deep.
Right.
So, Cheryl, I guess the short answer is that as I've written several times on my blog, Grammarphobia, and you could look it up if you want to put in slow and slowly in the search function, I do talk about the history of slow as an adverb, and it's very old, and it's nothing new. It's not that language has changed. It's always been that way.
Let's go to another call, and this one may have something to do, or I don't know whether it has something to do with Washington, with the Watergate hearings, but it would definitely fit. And this is Ken from Manhattan. Ken, you have a question for Pat.
Hello, Patricia. Hello, Julie.
Sounds like deep throat.
Yeah, well, I'll go deeper if you want.
Follow the money.
What I'm calling first is an expansion of the term that you used about the lawyerly talk with I don't recall. They frequently said, I don't recall at this time, mm-hmm. which was even
right.
a little creepier.
Yes,
but,
yes.
But I'm wondering about the origin of the word cahoots, which is a wonderful American word which applies to the so many of the Watergate people, but... I wonder if you know anything about that. We're always in cahoots. No one's ever out of cahoots.
Cahoots is something that you were in. You don't just engage in cahoots. You were actually in them. I don't know this off the top of my head, but I'm looking it up right now.
I love that you come with your very large dictionary.
Well, I keep this dictionary here at WNYC.
Ah, good, so you don't have to take it on the subway back and forth every time.
Yes. So here we go. Wrong page. This always drives Leonard crazy when I'm looking things up. He's tapping his fingers. Okay, cahoots. Informal, we knew that. It's from Old French, possibly a blend of the word cabane, which is hut or cabin. Oh, you know, I've read about this before.
So that you would be in that hut.
Yeah, there's a theory that thieves or... brigands or whatever would meet in a little rude hut or whatever to plan their nefarious deeds. And I think that's where In Cahoots might have come from. But I know that's one of the theories.
It's interesting because the way we use it now, it feels like a kind of state of mind or an experience that you're in with other people, but it started as a physical place that you were in cahoots.
Yeah, that's how figurative language comes along.
And that's what we could say all the Watergate burglars were in cahoots.
Yes.
In the Watergate.
Yes.
We have another question from Dan, or maybe a story. Dan in Bridgewater, you're on the air.
Yeah, I really despair at how history is being set aside and colorful terminology that was used more in Brophura than in anything else, and not as a legalistic term, really. Is given such emphasis. I mean, let's recall that the Nixon administration at that time was very preoccupied about ending the Cold War by splitting the Russians and the Chinese.
Mm-hmm.
And the issue of the campaign and the election may not have been something that was plotted way at the top, and I've listened to the tapes. I don't think that they really show that Nixon initiated the whole Watergate scandal. And, you know, the words without the context are really ahistoric and a tragic way of looking at our past, which is so pregnant with what's happening now.
Dan, I've heard from my producer that you have a connection to all of this. Can you tell us about that?
Yes, I did. I was involved, and by some stupidity, I was indicted. And when I got to Washington, it was totally wrong. And Hillary Clinton was then one of the aides there, who was extremely nice and made sure that I got justice and got sent home without any problem. So I have a very fond attachment to her.
Well, thank you so much for your story, Dan.
Okay.
Patricia, as we look at these words from Watergate, there are also phrases like when the going gets tough, the tough get going.
Oh, yes. That's one that wasn't... new at the time, but it was a favorite phrase of John Mitchell, who revived the expression. And it had earlier been used by Joseph P. Kennedy and others. But yeah, he was fond of saying that when people's nerves were on edge, he'd say, when the going gets tough, the tough get going. You know, speaking of Mitchell, Ehrlichman had a word for him. I don't know if he used it to him to his face, but there was a plot at one point that Dean would write a report and they would post-date it or predate it or whatever to give to the investigating committee to show that the whole plot, the whole burglary plot, was John Mitchell's. And Ehrlichman referred to Mitchell as the big enchilada. Haldeman and Ehrlichman were really good with language.
I hadn't realized, was it one of them that came out of the ad?
Well, Ehrlichman wasn't the ad man. That was Haldeman. Yeah. He called Mitchell the big enchilada, which was a pretty good term for him.
We have a call now from Mike from Jersey City. You have a question for Patricia O'Connor.
Yeah, hello, Patricia.
Hi.
Listen, I'm wondering, I'm a big fan of the Watergate stuff, and it all sounds like film noir stuff with the smoking gun and all that sort of stuff. I'm wondering where Slush Fund came from.
On a day like today, that makes a lot of sense. That's a good question.
That's a fund where you buy yourself new galoshes, I think. I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. I'm wondering if maybe it's by any chance in the dictionary, because you can never underestimate lexicographers. Let me see if I can find it here. Slush fund. Yeah, well, it's described, a fund raised for undesignated purposes. We know that. Doesn't say where it comes from, though. Money formerly raised by the sale of garbage from a warship to buy small items of luxury for the crew? Well, that's a new one. Well, maybe that was the origin.
It's got a good visual connotation.
It does.
That it's all the stuff that's sort of inchoate. Yes, and kind of running off of everything else.
Right.
So that it's a way of...
I did want to make one other point about Watergate, though, because... even people who weren't around, and even if we forget all this other language, we will always remember Watergate, the word Watergate, because long afterwards we still attach the suffix gate to any scandal to give it a really pejorative, hanky-panky sort of conspiratorial aura. But I think we have a clip on that subject, too.
Birth certificate gate.
Iran gate.
Travel gate.
Trooper gate.
Monica gate.
Benghazi gate.
NAFTA gate.
NAFTA gate.
Oh, my gosh.
Which
sounds like other things, too.
Yes.
It's the birth certificate gate. I mean, I'd heard about the birth certificate, but not birth certificate gate.
I know. It's often
it
a little
trip
awkward.
Off the tongue. No.
No. Those gate formations don't usually hang around for very long. Like, there was a tuna gate in Canada at one time because of tainted tuna. It was called Tuna Gate.
Do you have a sense of how long it took for gate to become the thing that would be attached to any scandal? Was it immediate, or did it take a few years?
I think it took a few years. The first one I remember was Iran Gate, which I think that was during the
Iran-Contra. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was where it referenced to arms sales to Iran that were to fund the Contra rebels in Nicaragua. And that was called Irangate. But I can't remember any ones in between. There may have been some.
As you watched the word Watergate and all of these phrases percolate through the culture, it sounds like gate is the one that probably will have the most staying power.
Yes, and gate, it has no meaning of its own. There's no image of a gate involved. It just
I remember
is there
when I first
because,
saw
yeah.
the Watergate apartment buildings. They're round. They're very.
I know.
I lived in Washington. It was like that wasn't what I
odd
pictured.
Or nebulous looking. They're not sinister looking. They're really blah. It's just an office and apartment complex that's really boring institutional architecture. And
which you I think can see from the Kennedy Center. That's I think one.
Oh,
of
you
its,
can.
Yeah.
Oh.
But that is interesting that gate is probably going to be the biggest legacy of this whole scandal.
Yeah.
Aside from what it did to us politically.
Yes, yes.
Well, as you look ahead, do you see anything going on right now that you think could engender this kind of...
Well, there could be Gungate coming up if there are any weird activities that arise from efforts to... obstruct gun safety legislation or that kind of thing. And I'm very interested in the way that the proponents of it really is gun control, have managed to turn the argument so that they are not using the term gun control as much. They're using gun safety or, even more telling, public safety.
Mm-hmm.
Because you might... you might legitimately, if you're a guy sitting out in Wyoming with your shotgun rack on your pickup truck, you might really argue against gun control. How can you argue against public safety?
Words are powerful.
They are.
I've been speaking with our resident word and grammar expert, Patricia T. O'Connor. Pat will be back on March 20th. And in the meantime, you can check out one of her books, which include Woe Is I and Origins of the Specious. Pat, thank you so much for joining us
today.
Thanks,
Julie.